I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The National Transportation Safety Board continues its investigation into the cause of yesterday's derailment of Amtrak Train 89 in Chester that killed two rail workers and injured dozens more on board. Joining me with the latest is WHYY's Bobby Allen. Bobby, what's come to light today?
Hey, Dave. So we didn't learn too much more except a few key details, namely that the operator of the train slammed the emergency brakes 5 seconds before colliding with a heavy piece of equipment. We also learned that they have troves and troves and troves of information that they're digging through now. The one main thing that we learned, too, was the speed at which the train was moving right before the collision. And that was 106 miles per hour. And investigators say that's well within the speed limit.
So the troves of information still to be analyzed are coming from the black boxes that have been recovered, and apparently there were cameras on board as well. Is it because there's so much data that it all has to be sifted through before we can really get to the bottom of it?
Yeah, the National Transportation Board officials today said they're really hesitant to speculate about anything, so they're only going by the incremental facts that they have at this point, and those include only a little bit of the analysis. The lab in Washington is going over forward and backward-facing cameras. There's other data recording devices that are being analyzed. And the really big question, which is why was this giant piece of equipment on an active track, is still not answered. Was that piece of equipment authorized to be there? Was the train that was moving 106 miles per hour on the right track? We still don't know the answers to those two questions, but in the coming weeks, we should have a more clearer picture.
It was disclosed early on that among the dozens who were injured, none of those injuries were considered life-threatening. Do we know more about the status of those who were on the train?
I think that's the latest, as far as I know. None of the injuries, the 30-some who were hospitalized, passengers who were hospitalized, most of them have been released. I know the engineer was also hospitalized, but his injuries are not considered life-threatening. The NTSB says that's kind of outside of their bailiwick. They wouldn't really talk about the status of any of the injured. But tomorrow, the NTSB will be interviewing the surviving members of the work crew, and that should help us understand what went wrong.
WHYY's Bobby Allen reporting. We're now a little more than 3 hours out from tip-off in Houston, and by evening's end, Villanova hopes to be crowned the 2016 NCAA men's basketball champion. We sent WHYY's Laura Benshoff out to the mainline campus this afternoon to check out the pregame scene. Laura, first up, is anybody going to classes today?
You know, there were people at classes. I saw people dutifully doing homework, but I did hear that all night classes were canceled to make way for people to be ready for the tip-off at 9:19 tonight.
I understand there were more students, though, gathered at the university store.
That's correct. It seems like there's been a rush. Nearly every person I saw was wearing a Villanova garb or Villanova pajamas or Villanova blankets or Villanova hair ribbons. And Ryan Snyder, the store manager, said that so far all of this school spirit has been very, very good for business.
It's been nonstop. We've doubled our sales for sure compared to last year at this time. And yesterday, you thought it was Black Friday here because they rushed the doors at 11 o'clock.
Not a surprise. I don't suspect, though, they're selling too many North Carolina Tar Heel memorabilia items.
I haven't seen any, and I think I might actually be the only Tar Heel fan on campus right now, because I am actually from North Carolina.
I hope you're in a safe place revealing that.
I've been told I should keep it hush-hush for the rest of the night.
So. All right, so let's talk about safety. What are accommodations for the expected throng and for students who are wanting to watch the game? What's the school setting up?
So the school is working with Lower Radnor Police. They've got a few dozen extra police on campus who will be setting up around the pavilion. That's the stadium here, and that's where they're expecting up to about 5,500 students to come and watch the game together. Other students are already lining up at various sports bars along Lancaster Avenue. And speaking of Lancaster Avenue, if the Wildcats do win tonight, you can expect the revelry to shut it down. The head of public safety at Villanova, Deborah Patch, is actually already planning on that. And she told me a little bit about where they're expecting to close the roads?
It will be, you know, from the Lower Merion area, possibly up to the Blue Route area.
She says that will be cleared out by tomorrow morning, though.
Now, in addition to accommodating students, I'm sure alum will be descending on the campus. And, of course, some of the star players hail from nearby. You have Ryan Archidiakono from Langhorne, Neshaminy High School, Michael Bridges from Malvern. He went to Great Valley. We could be seeing supporters from near and far.
We could. And, you know, the event isn't ticketed, so it's kind of come one, come all down to the pavilion and show your Wildcat spirit.
Thanks, Laura.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY's Laura Benchoff on Newsworks Tonight. But wait, there's more basketball news.
The Philadelphia 76ers select Allen Iverson from Georgetown University. Allen shakes, great, gets two!
Sixers great Allen Iverson will take his place in the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame later this year. He was voted into the hall today. Now, during his 14 years in the NBA, 11 with the Sixers, Iverson tied team records for points and steals per game and holds the record for three-pointers. He led the Sixers to one championship series, which they lost to the Lakers in 2001. Other inductees to the hall this year include big men Shaquille O'Neal and Yao Ming, and former WNBA star Cheryl Swoopes. The Federal Communications Commission passed a landmark resolution last week making low-income families eligible for a new federal subsidy for high-speed Internet access. As WHYY's Kevin McCoy reports, one of the commissioners visited a Philadelphia public school today to emphasize the need for such a measure in an era of digital learning.
According to the Pew Research Center, about 7 in 10 teachers across the country assign homework that requires access to the Internet. But more than 17% of families with school-aged children lack access to broadband in their homes.
That problem, where those numbers overlap, is what I call the homework gap.
FCC Commissioner Jessica Rosenworcel has been pushing for the federal government to help lessen this digital divide. She spoke to students and educators at String Theory Charter School's Center City campus.
If you want a fair shot at 21st century success, you're going to need to know how to use digital resources. You're going to need to be able to use them at home and at school.
At String Theory, every student receives an iPad that they can use 24/7. But some of the children are in that 17% lacking home access.
It really hurt my grades and all my learning, actually. So in ninth grade, I wasn't really doing so well in the first couple quarters.
Junior Amrose Dorville, who lives in the Frankfurt section of Northeast Philadelphia, was in that position for most of her life. It wasn't until midway through her freshman year that she learned about Comcast's Internet Essentials program, where low-income families with kids can get Internet for about $10 a month if they meet other eligibility requirements.
It really helped me. If you look at my grades from last year and now, they're really improving, and I can see myself learning more and just doing better.
But Dorville's family still struggles to make ends meet, especially when bills spike for necessities like heat or water.
When it becomes too high and then they have to cut off the Wi-Fi for that month, then I'm screwed.
That happened this winter. So during December and January, Dorville stayed at school every day until 6 p.m., to finish her homework.
And then teachers would walk by and say, why are you still here? I was like, I need the Internet.
Last week, Commissioner Rosenworcel and the two other Democrats on the five-member FCC panel approved a resolution making Internet for families like the Dorvilles practically free by offering a more than $9 monthly federal subsidy. Overall, as smartphones have grown in prevalence, the number of Americans with home broadband access has decreased in recent years. Rosenworcel warned against, though, putting too much stock in that trend.
No parent or teacher or student would think that it's optimal to sit around and do research, type a paper, apply for a job, apply for a scholarship, apply for college on a handheld device.
Kevin McCoury, WHYY News.
Still ahead, a doctor from Philadelphia was at the forefront of a group testing children for lead back in the mid-20th century.
When they did, they began to see that it was far more widespread than anyone had ever thought.
So why did it take so long to do something about it? Answers when NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
When playwright Sarah Burgess started writing her play about private equity firms, it was like learning a new language.
I think I was really drawn to the challenge of writing about a world that I'm not inside, but trying to sort of, at least to some degree, in a simplified form, mimic the way they might talk to each other when there's not an outsider present.
I'm Adrienne Hill. A play about finance that's also a comedy. That's next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Support for WHYY comes from the Rutgers Camden Professional MBA program. Designed for working professionals, the Rutgers Camden Professional MBA is a 21-month cohort-based program with classes held on Saturdays in two convenient locations, Camden and Princeton. The next cohort begins this fall. Rutgers' next information session is Wednesday, April 6th at 6 p.m. at the Cherry Hill Public Library in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Details at pmba.rutgers.edu or 856-225-2700.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. People have been using lead and knew it was poisonous for thousands of years, though it wasn't until the 1970s and the work of a doctor from Philadelphia that we found out what we know today. Even small amounts of lead can cause children long-term IQ deficits and learning disabilities. In part one of our series on the history of lead contamination, Keystone Crossroads reporter Marielle Segarra tells us about the story of that doctor and why almost 40 years on, the problem persists.
It's 1957. We're at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and Dr. Herbert Needleman is on his way to see a three-year-old patient. Needleman's a young doctor, 6 feet tall, with brown eyes and dark hair. This is the first case of lead poisoning he's ever seen, and when he shows up, the girl is not in good shape. Her eyelids are drooping, her pulse is slow, she's not making a sound.
This girl was lethargic and you know, almost comatose.
That's Lydia Denworth, who wrote a book about Needleman called Toxic Truth. Needleman has Alzheimer's disease and wasn't able to talk for this story. At the hospital, Needleman prescribes the girl medicine that gets rid of the lead in her blood. And over the next couple days, she starts to feel better. Needleman's feeling pretty good about himself.
He thought he had fixed her problem.
He talks to the mom and tells her, you know, your daughter's okay, but she was probably poisoned by lead paint or dust at your apartment, and you can't go back there.
And the mother just looked at him and said, well, where am I supposed to go? You know, she didn't have any money. She was a single mother. And suddenly, Needleman says it's like the scales fell from his eyes.
As a doctor, Needleman couldn't go home with his family and take the lead paint off their walls. This girl was probably going to end up back in the ER again. This patient marks the beginning of a lifelong crusade for Needleman. He goes on to make a huge discovery that changes the way we think about the dangers of lead. In the 1950s, when Needleman's a new doctor, lead is everywhere. Paint, pipes, toys, gasoline. You'd hear commercials like this one on the radio.
Drive up to the pump with the Ethel emblem and say, fill her up.
But Denworth says at this point, a lot of doctors aren't testing kids for lead because the symptoms of lead poisoning, like vomiting and seizures, look like other diseases. As an experiment, Needleman's hospital starts testing all kids for lead.
When they did, they began to see that it was far more widespread than anyone had ever thought.
After this, Needleman becomes consumed by thoughts of lead. This would be a good time to point out that everyone describes Needleman as a crusader against injustices, large and small. His son Josh tells a story about a canoe trip the family took when he was a kid. He and his father are paddling along a river, and they see a group of teenagers sitting around and smoking.
Generally, I think the kind of group that now as an adult I would try to avoid, and they were throwing rocks at a duck that was floating in the river.
Needleman gets really angry that they're trying to hurt this duck.
And he began to shout at them and said, leave that duck alone.
They're so shocked that they stop.
He could just not hold himself back when he saw something that was unjust.
Josh says the same thing went for lead. As Needleman sees all these kids come into the hospital with lead poisoning, he comes across a study from the 40s showing that children who'd been poisoned by lead later had behavioral problems and low IQ scores. And he starts to wonder, these children all had severe lead poisoning, but what about the smaller amounts of lead that most kids are exposed to every day? Could that be damaging their brains? He designs a study to find out. Lead builds up in the bones, so Needleman uses children's baby teeth to measure their lead exposure. He practices on Josh's teeth, which kind of rules out the tooth fairy. But that sort of myth would never have been a fixture in Needleman's home.
I can't imagine my father participating in a fiction in deliberately deceiving his children, even in fun. It's not the kind of person that he was.
After collecting the teeth, Needleman and another researcher test the kids to see if the ones who have high levels of lead also have these cognitive problems. Here he is describing the results in a PBS documentary years later.
We found that children who had high lead in their teeth, but who had never been identified as having any problems with lead, had lower IQ scores, poor language function, and poor attention.
Mariel Segarra, Keystone Crossroads.
The findings about the effects of lead are just the beginning of a decades-long battle to get it out of homes. Hear about how that battle is played out in part two of Marielle's story on tomorrow's show. Robert Bigelow was a young teenager when NASA launched Echo 1, the world's first inflatable satellite, August 12, 1960. Inspired, he decided he wanted to earn enough money so he could build his own space program. Let's learn how that worked out for him with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, there's an irony here. Bigelow went on to make his fortune in livable spaces on Earth.
Indeed, and I think that helped to inform him about plans he may have had for future space exploration as well. I think this is a really interesting story of entrepreneurship, interest in space exploration, and having a dream as a kid. Robert Bigelow is the owner of this company, of this string of budget hotels in the Southwest, through which he's made quite a sizable fortune. But the dream that he's had in mind since the age of 12 is to essentially create his own space program. And now he's doing just that. So the Bigelow Aerospace Company, as it's known now, specializes in creating inflatable modules that can be used in space for habitats or for laboratories or for any other kind of function in which a volume is needed that can successfully hold an environment.
Like what they called Echo 1, a sataloon.
A sataloon, yes. This is somewhat similar to that, except in this particular case, his devices are meant to be used like rooms. So instead of having a big spherical object, he actually constructs them using materials that are pliable enough that he can fold these down to take up a much smaller volume. And then on inflation, they will bring themselves up to a full volume that actually has more of a definable shape, sort of like a truncated, inflated cylinder, if you will. So the test article, known as BEAM, the Bigelow Expandable Activity Module, folds up to a very, very small size. It's about 3 cubic meters all folded up. It will be launched this Friday by a SpaceX launch vehicle, and then it will be attached to International Space Station at the Tranquility Node. Now, it will then be inflated by astronauts, and it will expand out to an object about the size of 16 cubic meters interior space. The testing that he is pursuing right now is to verify that they are able to withstand space radiation, micrometeoroid impact, as small asteroid impact. And NASA has already agreed that they see this concept as being viable. Now, during that time on International Space Station, it won't be used as a habitat full time. In fact, this is an extended 2-year test to test all those things to see if it's viable in the space environment. Astronauts will enter about 4 times a year and spend several hours each time. But while astronauts are not there, there are active sensors on board that will check all of the components to make sure that the environment is stable and that the structure itself is withstanding the rigors of space.
Is it Bigelow's dream that he one day go up in space?
You know, I'm not exactly sure, Dave, what his personal ambition for space is, but it may be a little bit different from others like Elon Musk or like Richard Branson. So, for example, Elon Musk has said that his desire is to eventually end up on Mars someday. Richard Branson says that in the first trip of his Virgin Galactic space transport that will take tourists to space, he'd like to go with his family and his elderly father. Jeff Bezos, who is working on a project under the name of Blue Origin, is also thinking about building this method for millions of people to be able to live and work in space easily.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, sign up with Outer Space Ways Incorporated.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Tomorrow evening, Newsworks theater blogger Howard Shapiro talks with Blanca Ziska, winner of this year's Vilcek Prize for Immigrant Artists. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
Supporting WHYY, Children's Regional Hospital at Cooper provides advanced pediatric care for South Jersey and beyond, with 5 general pediatric practices and 27 pediatric programs and specialties. Their fellowship-trained doctors and experienced nurses and staff deliver compassionate care for children and families in the hospital and in the community. To learn more about Children's Regional Hospital at Cooper, cooperhealth.org/children's or 1-800-8-COOPER.
Mount Cuba Center supports WHYY and offers special family-friendly programming on the second Saturday of every month. Saturday, April 9th features native spring blooms with special activities and picnic lunches available on-site from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Mount Cuba Center is a botanical garden located in Hockessin, Delaware, that promotes the conservation of native plants and the habitats that sustain them. Featuring a colorful meadow, tranquil ponds, and historic formal gardens. More at mountcubacenter.org.
The University of Delaware MBA supports WHYY. The UD part-time MBA offers busy professionals the opportunity to pursue their education and their careers with flexible online and on-campus options and a variety of specializations. Prospective students can drop in anytime during their upcoming information sessions on Wednesday, April 6th and Wednesday, April 20th from 4:30 to 7 p.m. Learn more about the University of Delaware MBA, including information on their national ranking from PayScale at udmba.com.